Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Church of Kent. We welcome all who yearn for religious freedom of thought, expression, and action. I'm Christy Anderson, today's worship leader and this congregation's commissioned lay leader. I'm joined by our worship associate today, Kathy Kearns. I'd like to extend a warm welcome to those who are here for the first time. I encourage you to stop by the table outside the sanctuary doors after the service, where someone from the membership committee can answer your questions and provide you with information. I'd like to draw the attention of both visitors and members alike to the white cards in the pew holders. These cards enable you to provide information about your talents and volunteer interests, and also a way for you to indicate if you would like someone from the church to contact you. I invite everyone to join us for coffee hour downstairs after the service. Or for a quieter environment and tea, you can socialize just outside the sanctuary door in Founders Lounge, where you also will have the opportunity to ask questions about the church from people who are wearing name tags bearing a question mark. I have two announcements this morning. First, if you're interested in offering a sermon or an entire worship service, the Sunday Program Committee invites you to complete a proposal form, which you can find on the table outside the sanctuary doors or also at our website. I'd also like to remind you of the annual auction of goods and services that will take place on Saturday, October 24th at 6 p.m., The theme is Standing on the Side of Love, to coincide with the UUA's public advocacy campaign. This is the church's biggest fundraiser of the year. Tickets are $15 and will include childcare if needed. Visit their table during coffee hour, where you can purchase tickets or submit a donation. I hope that you'll join us next week when our minister, Reverend Melissa Carville-Zeemer, will lead a service about our shared promises, entitled Seeking the Center. Within this sacred space and loving community, may you find that which you seek.
We light this chalice for the children of the world of all colors.
We come together this morning to worship in community. We could have stayed in our cozy, dry homes, yet we ventured here to be in this place with this community. Here, there are gifts we may not find anywhere else this week. Here, we may feel our souls touched, our connections to others renewed, our spirits lifted, our lives changed, our settled beliefs and actions called into question. The local congregation can provide us all of these things. Today is also Association Sunday, a day to reflect on and celebrate that we are also part of a much larger Unitarian Universalist community. As Eric Wickstrom says, just as we come together as individuals to make this congregation, so our Unitarian Universalist congregations come together to form an association, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, because we need more than we can find in our aloneness. We guard our independence and individuality, yet in our togetherness, we are so much more than we can ever be on our own. Today, we affirm our common bond and purposes with Unitarian Universalist congregations across the nation. Come, let us worship together.
Good morning. I have a question. Who among you likes stories? Show me if you like stories. Raise your hand. Just as I figured, most everyone. Most of us have favorite books that we love, favorite childhood storybooks. We hear stories on the news. People are buzzing about the news that Rio de Janeiro will have the Olympics in 2016. Those are stories. We also have stories that come from religious traditions, important stories that we hear all the time. The Christian story of Jesus' birth that we hear at Christmas time, the Jewish story of Noah and the flood, and even Unitarian Universalist stories, such as the story of flower communion or the story of how John Murray brought universalism to America. And if you don't know those Unitarian Universalist stories, stick around because you're bound to hear them here. And many of our families tell stories. We tell stories of our parents and our grandparents. And who among you has heard stories about your own childhood, stories about when you were a little one and all the cute things that you said and did? So these are all important stories that we tell. And one kind of story that I really like is a biography, because it tells the life story of someone. But we sometimes think that we already know a lot about a person, but without really knowing their story. So take George Washington for an example. We all think we know George Washington. We all know he was the first president of the United States. We all know he was a general in the Revolutionary War. You may know that he had false teeth that were made of wood. We think that we know him so well that most of us even carry a photograph of him in our wallets. He's on the dollar bill. That's George Washington. But unless we read about Washington's life story or hear about his life story, we really wouldn't know what Washington cared about, what he feared, who he loved, or what he thought. So I wonder what would happen if we all told each other our stories and listened to the stories of others. And I wonder what would happen then if we understood what our friends and family cared about, what they feared, what they loved, what they thought. And I wonder what would happen if our families and friends understood what we cared about, what we fear, what we love, what we think. And maybe you wonder these things too. So I encourage you today and every day to learn the stories of those you care about and to tell them your own, because understanding our stories connects us to each other and it makes our lives better and it makes their lives better.
I invite you to widen your focus and to bring to mind those in your life for whom you care. Let us join together now in celebration of our joys and in solemn recognition of our sorrows and losses. Today we join in celebrating the birth of twins to Bethany and Eric Snyder. Alice Colleen and Benjamin Peter were close to 5 pounds each when they were born last week. Bethany and the babies are healthy and are all at home. Please join me in a time of prayer. The Spirit of life in us and around us fills us with the desire to live like we wish the world would live. But at times we're disappointed in ourselves as we succumb to temptations, prejudices, and the easiest path. May we find within ourselves the courage to live according to the values we hold most dear. We recognize that the journey is not always easy, and we cannot change some of what life gives to us. But may we be mindful that we possess the power to choose how we deal with what we are given. Let us trust that our hearts and minds will guide us, and that we will find the words that need to be spoken, and recognize the actions that make us whole. Together, we can make possible justice and love. Amen.
I'm opening to others. with the actions of my hands and the guidance of my heart. In the work of loving kindness, I'm ready to do my part. I am reaching out in peace with an opening circle. My family is extending beyond my comprehension. Every person that's before me is the one that I'm befriending. As the circle grows, I'm not alone, and I know I'm only one among many. I become the light, light as a feather, and I am only part of a love that lasts forever. I'm holding out my hand for my brothers and my sisters. I'm walking on this land, and it's turning into heaven. I am reaching out in peace. I am reaching out in peace. I am reaching out in peace within an opening circle. I am widening my circle. I am widening my circle. I am opening to others. I am opening to others. With the actions of my hands, in the guidance of my heart, in the work of loving kindness, I'm ready to do my part. I am reaching out in peace, opening circle.
Recently, Newsweek magazine published an article about the development of the awareness of race in children. Studies indicate that children are aware of skin color differences as toddlers. By the age of 3, children are mentally categorizing things in their world. By this young age, they've already formed impressions about people who are different than themselves, thus prompting the authors to call for race education to begin before children even enter kindergarten. They also studied families to identify the lessons about race conveyed to the young children by their parents. It was revealed that in households containing children of color, parents discuss race frequently with their children starting at about the age of 4. Whereas most white parents don't openly discuss race at all with their preschool or adolescent children. Most stated they wanted their children to have an attitude of acceptance, but either they didn't know what to say or were afraid that they would do damage by drawing attention to race. As the authors noted, The parents worry that even a positive statement such as, "It's wonderful that a black person can be president," still encourages children to see divisions within society, which contradicts a message that skin color doesn't matter. The article prompted me to reflect on my past practices as a parent of two boys. I couldn't think of any times when I discussed the topic of race with them until they were in high school. I've had a very close black friend for over 25 years who spent a lot of time with my boys. They were very close, and I guess I always felt that they were learning open-mindedness from this relationship, and I never felt compelled to do anything more deliberate. Continuing with my self-examination, I then gave some thought to the possibility of any subtle teachings that I might have conveyed to them. I recalled a number of occasions driving through urban areas with the boys, when we traveled through neighborhoods with vacant and run-down buildings and a predominance of black faces among the people on the sidewalks. I usually said, "Boys, lock the car doors." I shudder now at the power of that message, especially given the absence of deliberate and thoughtful discussions about race with my children. I've always taken pride in my ability to ignore the color of someone's skin in the ways that I perceive and treat them. However, based on my recent reading and discussions on racism, I now realize that when people of color hear a white person speak with pride in claiming to be colorblind, they react with sadness, frustration, and even outrage. In America, if you have skin darker than that of Euro-American whites, you can never be blind to skin color. As UU minister Mark Morrison Reed, a black man, notes in his book, In Between, a black man's survival in a white world depends upon awareness of his blackness every day, every hour. He writes, "At times my life feels like an excruciating experiment. Racial integration means being one of a few blacks in a sea of white. It means awkward situations and embarrassment lurking near, and so fosters in me an almost aberrant cautiousness. The reason that race and ethnicity has to matter to people of color is that it matters to those of us who are members of the dominant culture, even if we don't recognize or acknowledge it." I'd like to offer one example of institutional racism and my role in perpetuating it. Before I retired, I was executive director of the Portage Metropolitan Housing Authority and oversaw a subsidized rental housing program that required low-income families to use their subsidy to rent privately owned housing. In analyzing the fact that black households were underrepresented as participants in the program, I found that black renters, especially single black mothers receiving public assistance, were unsuccessful in finding a landlord who would accept their subsidy. My solution was to help black renters to be more competitive in finding housing. We gave them suggestions about how to dress, how to talk about themselves, what to do with their kids when meeting with a potential landlord. This strategy didn't produce the results that we had hoped it would. Now, 20 years later, I realize that two injustices are revealed in this example. One was my own role in defining the problem through my limited viewpoint. By developing our makeover instructions for the black women, we were trying to make these low-income single mothers appear to be more like us, more middle class, more white. I was guilty of defining the victims as the problem and trying to change them rather than focusing on the heart of the problem, the prejudiced attitudes of the landlords. I could have attempted to educate landlords, but that seemed like an overwhelming task for which I was unprepared and ill-equipped. And that's what happens all too often with matters of race. The anticipation of the arduous task becomes an excuse for inaction. To do nothing is to be part of the problem. My second reason for sharing this example is to illustrate a program designed by Congress that has racial outcomes in its implementation. The program focuses on low-income people, forces low-income people to compete against one another for limited resources. The power holders, at least in Portage, are predominantly white property owners. These owners, not the program administrators, decide which individuals are able to benefit from the housing subsidy program by selecting them as their tenants. The low-income people having the greatest need were those least often selected by the landlords. In this instance, I was an unquestioning, oblivious white inheritor of a system that continues to recreate new ways of exploiting people of color. When I participated in Melissa's class on white privilege, I realized that racial and ethnic injustice is more than looking through the lens of color and acknowledging the unequal treatment of people of color. It's also looking through the lens of my whiteness and recognizing that all whites, including myself, benefit by being a member of the dominant class that makes the rules and holds the power. I had my eyes open to rights and privileges I automatically receive that others don't. Education about anti-racism is an intellectual way of learning about racial and ethnic injustice. However, today's service is about another approach to learning, one involving the sharing of human stories about the experience of living in our community as people who are different than those of us who are white Euro-Americans. Now, I'll admit, I love facts and statistics. As a professional, I was well-versed in national and local statistics about poverty and housing discrimination. And intellectually, I understood that it was important to promote equal housing opportunities. But the impact of these statistics on me paled in comparison to the real-life stories I heard from my black friends and co-workers. Over the years, my heart ached for the black people I knew who repeatedly experienced racial prejudice and discrimination in this community. Because these individuals were willing to share with me their stories of injustice and anguish, I realized that blacks in this community don't have the freedoms that I take for granted. I was profoundly touched and have come to realize the impact that shared stories can have on our attitudes. And this is why I believe we need to have racially and ethnically diverse congregations. Church is the place where we bear our hearts, share our sorrows, and whisper our dreams. We need to immerse ourselves in a community rich in stories about all aspects of life around us. We're fortunate to have people within our community and within our church who can offer us lessons about reality and shed a different perspective on life. Here are some of their stories.
Good morning. My name is Vivian Sandlin. This past summer, my 7-year-old daughter, Anna, came home crying from an afternoon at play with the neighborhood children. She told me that one of her friends had called her Chocolate Face, Alarmed, I asked her about the context for the remark, but seven-year-olds aren't always so great at explaining context. She did say that her friend had made the comment in anger at her, and I understood that this comment had been intended to insult and to hurt. I decided that I had to speak to the neighborhood children to make this a teachable moment. Now, the child who made the comment said that, indeed, she had called Anna the name because she had been mad at her. I explained carefully that children of all colors are beautiful and that it's bad for anyone to try to hurt someone else by putting them down for who they are or for how they look. I said that when we are upset at a friend, we should say, "I'm angry at you because you hurt my feelings." As I said this, I was struck by how much trouble we adults often have at expressing anger in non-hurtful ways, and then how then do we expect children to do this? The children all nodded, and then they returned to playing together. I'm not sure I made much difference at all. I hope I did. Anna seemed to forget the incident, but I didn't forget it. I know that I had to stand up for Anna, because this was not the first time something like this had happened. Now, I adopted my daughter Anna from Guatemala when she was 5 months old. I had read about how adoptive parents can address the racism that our children will encounter, the thoughtless comments of adults, or the innocent and uninformed comments of other children. I was not quite prepared for how early the comments would occur, or how ill-equipped preschool and even school teachers would be for addressing these comments. Anna began to notice that she looked different from other kids when she was very small, and she felt the sting of other people's remarks when she was just 3.5 years old. She told me one day, "A boy in preschool said that my skin color is ugly." I spoke to the preschool teacher about it, and she replied, "Oh, our children would never say something like that. Anna must have misunderstood." I didn't press her on this, and I wish now that I had. I was so shocked by her denial and so concerned about being polite and non-confrontational that I just dropped it. Anna attended kindergarten in Garrettsville because the all-day program there is free, and they admitted her through open enrollment, which was very generous of them. Anna used to say to me, "I'm the only one in the whole school with brown skin," and she was almost right. The children and the teachers were all nice to her, and she was very popular. But her teacher never talked about the class with the class about differences. She never talked with the class or the other kids about skin color. She never talked with the children about human diversity. There was no overt racism that I saw. There was just silence. Many teachable opportunities were missed, I think. I moved Anna to Wall School in Kent for first grade. Now, the Kent City schools are far from perfect, but Anna was and is much happier. She was delighted that there were 4 other children in her first grade class with brown skin. I don't know to what extent the teacher talked about differences between children, but I know that Anna feels more comfortable now. She has 4 other children in her second grade class with brown skin, and she likes to eat breakfast with another girl who is African American. I talk with Anna all the time about people's differences and people's commonalities. I tell her every day that she is beautiful. We talk about her birth mother, though I know little about her. I worry that in our collective discomfort over race and racial differences, that we adults don't talk about differences and diversity much with our children. I know that Anna's teachers have been reluctant to talk about this. It's easier to talk about spelling than it is to talk about race and racism. I think we have a responsibility to all our children to talk about skin color differences and other differences that make us who we are, as well as to talk about what we have in common. As our children get older, we have a responsibility to teach them about the history of racism and slavery and segregation and discrimination, and about the struggle of people of goodwill to change these things. I think all children need to learn about this history. Now, I hope that as parents and as teachers and church members and adults of good conscience, we will have the courage to talk openly with our children about these things, even when we are uncomfortable. Honest conversation matters to our children. And I thank the members of our congregation for being such a great, caring community for Anna over the past 7.5 years.
We'll now hear from Carol Beatty and her daughter Kaylee.
Rosa sat so Martin could walk, so Obama could run. Shouldn't that now mean that I can fly? I have trouble understanding those who, quote, don't see color. Why the hell wouldn't you want to see color? And if you don't see in color, do you see in black and white? Maybe a shade of gray? Why is it now that we have a black person as president and concludes racism in America? As far as I knew, blacks, and since that happens to be the opposite, whites, are not the only two races in America, much less the world. So since someone on your opposable scale gets to the top of power, then that person fills in for the whole gray area, right? As a high school student, people who don't see in color might just be the problem. They are the ones who point fingers and say whether you act black or white. Is that not racism? There are still people who ask ignorant questions. For example, how one teacher at my school asked my black 6'1" boyfriend if he played any sports, specifically basketball. Is it just a coincidence that although I was globally gifted in elementary school and middle school, and although I was gifted in elementary school, they accidentally left me off in middle school until I was in eighth grade, where I found out that I was the only one of two black people in the program? It's the same in high school. I was the only one out of two people who was taking all advanced classes. Maybe it's been a long time since you stepped into a high school. I think whether you see in color or not, it's easy to see the tables of mostly black people and the tables of white people who are labeled as acting white or vice versa. Actions speak louder than words, but racist words are still being spoken, even if they are said in a nicer way. Would I be fooling myself if I thought someone asking me why I act white isn't just a 21st century version of wondering why I don't act like a good little Negro girl?
At five, I really didn't know what nigger girl meant or why my teacher needed to announce to the class that this is Carol and she's the same as everyone. If I was the same, why did she have to say it? Maybe she meant my hair. I knew my hair didn't flow with the wind like my white adopted mom's, and that mine was even harder to comb. Everyone else had flowy hair like mama's. Did non-flowy hair mean nigger? Even though every day of kindergarten I was scared of my new nickname, neither my teacher nor my sister Barbie or I ever told my parents. I didn't know why, but even then I knew talking about it made people feel uncomfortable. Second grade was much better. I was relieved to only hear the N-word twice before lunch on my first day at the new school. I was even excited when my new teacher, Mrs. Legg, told me I didn't have to read out loud to the class because she already knew what reading group I was in. I felt proud that Mama must have told her I was an excellent reader, but I realized later that the red book was the beginner book. I wanted the green book, like my best friend Nancy, who got up and read every word correct in front of the class. I asked Miss Legg if I could show her how I could read the green book, and she told me to hush and sit down. I cried when I got home, so Mama wrote Miss Legg a note and asked her to please let me read out loud. The next day, Mrs. Legg asked me if I was memorizing after I got every word correct on the first page. She then asked me to turn to the last page in the green book. But again, I got every word right. After that, she told me that there are no green books left, but I could share with Nancy. In fifth grade, I lived on the west side of Cleveland. And even though I knew I was the only black person in my school and neighborhood, not one person called me nigger. Elizabeth was my best friend. After school, I would usually go to her house to hang out. When her dad came home, he would pat me on the head and say I was a good one. I thought he meant I was a good kid. When Cleveland started busing kids from the east side to the west side, so, as my dad would say, everyone could meet and all get along, I was part of the welcome group that arrived early. I wanted to be part of welcoming the new children with hair and skin like mine. Elizabeth was absent that day, but her dad and many other parents came to the school before the new kids' bus started pulling in. But before the new kids could get off the bus, Elizabeth's dad and many of my other friends' parents started throwing things and shouting mean things like, "Niggers, go home!" They all cheered when the bus drivers pulled off with the new kids still inside. When I was 2, I was fortunately adopted by white parents who loved me very much and told me daily that I was the same. Unfortunately, their words didn't fully prepare me for being black in America. They didn't prepare me to deal with why Earl was grandpa to my white adopted brother, and why at first Barbie and I weren't even allowed to go over our adopted grandparents' home. My well-meaning parents didn't fully prepare me to understand that's not that I was a good one or an exception to the rule, or why that despite all that they said, I secretly believe society's message that to be black is to be on welfare, lazy, a thief, violent, angry, promiscuous, and that everyone knew even the bad guys were black because black was bad. Sadly, my way of coping was believing that I was the exception to this rule. With my children, I knew simply telling them that everyone's the same would not prepare them to reject the negative messages. Even in the age of the first black president, to pretend that society says everyone is equal and treated the same would not fully prepare them to understand why, despite great references, we've always had trouble running a house even in Kent. Why their Auntie Barb, who had perfect credit, almost did not get the house that she wanted in the neighborhood of her choice. Or how Uncle DJ, an honor graduate student with no criminal history, had been falsely jailed and accused of a crime he did not commit, despite being at work on the other side of Akron when the crime occurred. Or why, if they're ever with Uncle Steve, who's white, there's no worry about being pulled over by the police just for looking suspicious. I know that simply telling my children that well-meaning people saying that they do not see color will not fully prepare them for the more subtle discrimination that continues on to this day. I wish I had the answer for fully preparing them to ignore all the stereotypes that are based on the color of their skin, to fully ignore some of their black friends' beliefs that getting high grades or talking proper is acting white, or to falsely believe that they are either the exception to the rule or have been held to a lesser standard if they are excelling in anything other than sports. How do I fully prepare my children for dealing with the realities of being black in America without being psychologically unprotected or becoming angry, paranoid, and bitter in a very challenging world?
I believe that church is the appropriate venue for addressing issues of anti-racism. UU Minister Rebecca Parker refers to engaging in anti-racism efforts as soul work because it requires honest self-scrutiny, acceptance of the fact that the process will involve tension, and exposing our vulnerability in order to restore our wholeness. This indeed is the work of religion. Parker explains that this soul work begins first with education, followed by engaged presence with people different than ourselves. Melissa began the educational process with the anti-racism class she led. Unfortunately, the next step, engaged presence, can only take place if there's inclusive representation at the table. As I worked on this section of the sermon, I felt a deep commitment to the idea of attracting people of color to our faith. I was motivated by a sense of caring because I want others to benefit from what we have to offer. But I have to confess that initially, I caught myself forgetting that this has to be a two-way relationship. People of color have gifts that they, in turn, can contribute to my church experience. I had to remind myself that I was viewing church diversity again through my white centrist viewpoint, and I needed to expand my lens. It's not appropriate to promote congregational diversity because of my own sense of guilt or moral inadequacy, even if it is grounded in compassion. I need to recognize the richness of the experience that others can contribute to my growth. To assertively invite people to join us, people who are different in terms of traditions, history, religious heritage, and cultural stories, is both exciting and frightening. We could be changed by taking to heart their stories. Are we willing to be transformed? Many in this church community work tirelessly outside of church on social justice issues. We come to church to be renewed from the toll that this work takes on our spirits. When I first started attending this church 9 years ago, I sought respite here, as I was immersed in turmoil and conflict all day long at work. I didn't want to come to church and hear about conflict, social problems, and politics in the sermons. I simply wanted to bask in the warmth of fellowship and feel reconnected to humanity. But a funny thing happened along my journey. While I've been here, I've learned a great deal about the issues and challenges facing members of this church who are part of the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community. With the safe haven of open discussion and personal interactions provided by this church, I would not have developed the understanding I now have about sexual orientation issues, nor would I have developed the degree of outrage that I have come to know about the denial of gay rights. I've experienced personal growth as I learned about the struggle of gays. That same awakening awaits us when we experience the pains, challenges, and dreams of people of different ethnic and racial backgrounds. We need to engage in tough soul work for the sake of our children, not just the children of the world or the children of our community, but in particular for the children who sit beside us in church. As a congregation consisting of predominantly white children, we need to make a concerted effort to engage in meaningful discussions about race with our children starting at a young age. We also have children among us characterized by racial and ethnic heritages different from the white European dominant group. We need to nurture, support, protect, and prepare our children for a world that will misunderstand them, mistreat them, and deny them basic rights. This is an awful reality for those of us who embrace this life-affirming spirit of this faith. UUs hold an optimistic view of humankind, and it pains us to acknowledge that we would have to prepare our children for a sometimes cruel world. It's asking us to remove the rose-colored glasses and confront our feelings of discomfort. Soul work requires getting our hands dirty in life's messy work. But it's also work that will enrich us and give us balance within a broken world. We cannot be complete and whole without opening ourselves to this necessary soul work. We've begun by sharing and listening to stories of pain and fear as expressed by our fellow church members. We must continue the dialogue and bring others into the conversation. It takes whites to correct injustices, but we can't do it without having our eyes opened and our hearts touched by those seeking empowerment. For those wanting information on ways the church can affirm diversity and confront racism, I invite you to pick up a handout on the table outside the sanctuary door as you leave. Or you may want to consider joining a local, racially integrated group formed by the Ravenna United Church of Christ, whose sacred conversations include our minister and several members of this congregation. By being more visible in the community and demonstrating that we're open to educating ourselves and engaging with people different than ourselves, our church is making a public statement that may make people of color more comfortable stepping through our door. And when they do, we must establish a relationship of honesty and trust. We must work to deliberately extend our hand and offer the gifts of Unitarian Universalism. And we must accept from their hand the insights and gifts they bring to us. Rather than expecting newcomers to mirror us, we must be willing to be changed and enriched by the relationship. I conclude with a quote from the new president of the UUA, Peter Morales, who states, "My dream for Unitarian Universalism is that we confess that we do not have all the answers. I dream that we will begin a conversation, a deep spiritual dialogue about how we can learn to be open to each other, and especially to work together to create a community and a culture that celebrates all it means to be human. We not only have gifts to each other, we are gifts to each other. We must not forget that. May the difficult but important conversation continue, and may our hearts be open to transformation. Let it be so. Amen."
Will the ushers please come forward? Every month we take up a special collection to support a group outside our church whose work is consistent with our church mission and values. Today our special collection is for the benefit of Companion Congregations and the Unitarian Universalist Association to support the UUA's efforts to grow our diversity, that is, to help our church become more welcoming to people from different racial, cultural, and economic backgrounds. As former UUA President Reverend Sinkford said, "Now is the time to grow our faith, to let people know we are here, and to welcome those who seek our community of peace, justice, and love. Now is the time for our congregations to grow more effective because our religious values are sorely needed to help heal a wounded world." So there are these special envelopes in your order of service I want to draw your attention to that are for the special donations for Association Sunday. You can put your cash, checks, or credit cards in here, made out to the UUA. There are also other envelopes in the pews if you'd like to make a donation to the church. And if you're a visitor, we have a small gift for you. You're welcome to take a candle home today.
As Unitarian Universalists, we have a calling in this world. We are called to respect differences with dignity and to challenge those who would forbid it. We are people of a wide path. Let us be wide in affection as we go forth and greet the world. Go now in peace. Amen.